coming weeks, I will issue an executive order requiring federal contractors to pay their federally funded employees a fair wage of at least $10.10 an hour, because if you cook our troops' meals or wash their dishes, you should not have to live in poverty.
That's President Barack Obama from his 2014 State of the Union address. He isn't alone in his concerns about the income gap in the United States. Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Conservatives are concerned as well, but their prescription for recovery stands in something of a contrast to the president's. Coming up, we'll hear from a policy analyst with the conservative think tank Heritage Foundation. But first, we review the history of income inequality and how it relates to the current debate in the U.S. Joining us is Ohio State University history professor and director of the OSU Public History Program, Stephen Kahn. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann. Thank you for having me.
The United States has been fighting inequality since the 1960s, at least, when Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty. 50 years later, is there any sense that we've made any particular progress?
That's a great question. And that 50th anniversary year that we're in right now is a nice excuse to pause and assess this. I think one of the things that became commonplace in the 1980s was to say, as the president at the time, Ronald Reagan, said, we fought a war on poverty and poverty won. That wasn't really true. In fact, when we look at the poverty numbers across the 1960s and even into the early 1970s, all kinds of indicators suggested that, in fact, we were, if not winning, we were certainly doing better in lifting people out of poverty. Then in the 1970s, things began to stagnate. So I think that, and we can talk about why that might have been, by the 1980s, poverty really was off the political agenda. And so I think at that point, a different set of economic ideas and economic policies took shape that that treated poverty as an unavoidable consequence and not something to be attacked necessarily directly.
To what extent are the policies, the thrust of policies, strong or weak or however they may manifest, related to what poverty looks like and whether or not we can actually see it?
That's an interesting question. I think one of the things that happened in the 1960s, and some listeners may remember this, that during the presidential campaign of 1960, so even before Johnson, John Kennedy read what was at the time a very famous book by Michael Harrington about poverty in America, and went to West Virginia and looked at poverty. And even then, there was this sense that America's most impoverished populations were somehow tucked out of sight. And so we had to go explore, in a sense. We went to Appalachia and we went to certain urban neighborhoods on the south side of Chicago or in East Harlem, New York, or wherever it happened to be. And there you would find these pockets of extraordinary desperation that had really been hidden from sight as the mainstream of America had grown so prosperous in the 1950s and 60s. And so I think highlighting the problem was one of the victories, if you will, that the early anti-poverty efforts scored. It made us all aware that this was happening in America, that people went to bed hungry, that kids didn't have shoes to go to school, and so on and so forth, in places like, you know, Western North Carolina and large parts of West Virginia and even Southeast Ohio. So just letting people know about that was one of the first tasks that we took on.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Professor Stephen Kahn. He's a history professor at Ohio State University. We're talking this hour about the income gap, the inequality, the 1% that we hear a lot about. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What is the, maybe we can look at it from pre and post 1960s era, but in any event, is the income gap, is the inequality that we're talking about today a relatively new phenomenon, or does it reach back well beyond. Of course, we remember the Great Depression.
Right.
But even beyond that.
Yeah. So let's imagine that modern America, capital M, capital A, begins after the Civil War. And what I really mean by that is that that's when the modern industrial capitalist economy really matured and settled in and became the way of life. Agriculture became increasingly less important in our economic development. So let's talk about the last 150 years, give or take.
Mm-hmm.
If we look at inequality, economic inequality, what over that 150 years, we can imagine it, crudely speaking, as a big bell curve, that inequality by the turn of the 20th century had grown pretty dramatically, so that by World War I, the top 1% was earning 20% of all the income. And the 99% was earning the rest of the 80% income. Then in the middle years of the 20th century, and again, really after the Second World War, so let's call it the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, that inequality gap began to shrink. And so by, you know, let's say the 1960s, that top 1% was now only earning about 10% of the total income, and the rest of us were sharing a larger share of it. Then in the 1980s, the arrows moved back and started, and the income inequality gap began to grow again, so that today, give or take, we're more or less back where we were at about 1900.
Now,
so it's this big sort of bell curve of the inequality gap.
Now, the 1980s were the Ronald Reagan years, mm-hmm. and that's when we were supposed to have trickle-down economics.
Correct.
Which was
yes.
supposed to do exactly the opposite.
Right. Well, you'll remember that the most, I think, astute analysis of that particular economic policy was offered by candidate George H.W. Bush, who then became Vice President George H.W. Bush, when he called that voodoo economics. Nothing ever trickled down. Though, in fairness, for the vast majority of Americans, that broad middle class that we like to talk about, wages and income really began to stagnate earlier than 1980. It stagnated with the great kind of economic malaise of the 1970s, but mm-hmm. it certainly did not pick up in the 1980s, though we were all promised that it would, nor did it pick up again in the early 2000s when we had another version of trickle-down economics. There was a moment right at the end of the 1990s during the tail end of the Clinton economy when middle class incomes actually began to rise again. But then by 2001, the arrows were pointed in the wrong direction again.
Now, we know that it wasn't because of an increase in industrial output. What was the cause of the uptick there in the 90s?
Well, I think that the economy, what happened in the 1990s was that a variety of things, not the least of which was the internet revolution,
right.
which really did
.com.
That's right,
yep.
which transformed the American economy in ways that, frankly, we're still sorting out.
Mm-hmm.
You had a combination of tremendous economic growth and which brought around very low unemployment. Unemployment was remarkably low through the second half of the 1990s, but very low inflation. And this was not exactly, didn't follow the economic models. When you have what's called the Phillips curve, when you have low unemployment, that's supposed to put an inflationary pressure on things. But it didn't happen. Unemployment was remarkably low, and so was inflation. So the money you took home held its value in a way that in an inflationary economy, it would lose its value. So people had more money, in a sense, to spend on things in the 1990s. And that's part of what contributed to that boom economy.
For some reason, that more money in circulation didn't drive up costs.
That's correct. That's right. And it was, as I said, that was the moment, again, let's talk about 1996, 97, 98, when the middle class started to do a little better again. But it was a momentary blip when the dot-com bubble burst, and we wound up in that small recession at the beginning of the new millennium. Middle class income stagnated again, and then of course we had the Great Recession in 2007, and middle class incomes took another big hit
and did not recover,
and have not recovered.
But the 1% did very well.
They've insulated themselves very nicely, and I think that leads to all kinds of important questions about why we should care about all of these numbers and these mm-hmm. graphs and these charts, because the extent to which we really are creating a society in which some people are going to have regardless, and some people are going to have not regardless, I think poses some real challenges for a democratic society.
French economist Tom Piketty has warned in his bestseller, his blockbuster bestseller, Capital in the 21st Century.
Yeah, I wish I could sell that many books.
No kidding. That inequality is likely to grow because capitalism tends to reward the owners of capital with a greater and greater share of the economy's output, while wage earners reap less and less of a share. Is there a policy framework out there that aims to get a useful amount of capital into the hands of the 99%? Or is it always about cutting tax rates? Or is it just about cutting tax rates?
So, you know, let's go back to my curve for a moment. When the economy fell off the cliff in 1929, that was a moment at which American politicians and policymakers decided perhaps we need a new approach. And that approach, as it settled in after the Second World War, included higher tax rates on more people, which then created more government spending during times of economic slowdown. That's the Keynesian formula. Mm-hmm. The economy slows down, government picks up the slack by spending. And it was a period of larger union employment and union growth in the 1950s and early 1960s. That was the period when the middle class did best in the United States. Now, union membership is as low as it's been probably for 100 years, at least as a percentage of the workforce. We have lowered those tax rates, especially on top income earners and corporations. We have pared back government spending except on military and defense programs. And we've created and what we have is this extraordinary growth in inequality. So it seems to me that we know what policies achieved greater equity for the middle class in the past, but we've abandoned them and we charted a different economic course. And I think Professor Piketty's prescriptions are therefore pretty simple in that book of his. We have to start taxing at higher rates, and we have to start protecting labor in a way that it hasn't been protected in the past generation.
Can we separate American inequality, American wage gaps from the rest of the world, or at least the rest of the Western world? Do they operate independently, or is there some interdependence going on there?
There's obviously some interdependence going on there. And I think that when you look around the world, you see variations of the same phenomenon. And not even just in the Western world. Income inequality is now something that is haunting the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party right now, because extraordinary gaps now between the very wealthy and and those factory workers in Shenzhen who are making your iPhone. I do think that as compared to Western economies, so let's say the United States, Canada, and Western Europe, the United States' problem with inequality is larger, though it is, I don't think, it's not unique. And I think that's part of the interesting thing about Professor Piketty's book, is that it's really a comparison of the American situation with Britain and France, and discovering many of the same things, even if the American inequality gap is a little more exaggerated. But certainly if you compare it to Scandinavian countries, America looks more like an outlier.
Are there any important historical correlations we should note between the success of democracy and the distribution of wealth?
It's been a truism for a long time that democracy and capitalism go hand in hand. That's a kind of foundational belief, especially in some conservative quarters. I think the rise of China suggests that those two things don't necessarily have to be linked at all. You can have lots of free market capitalism and a repressive state that has no interest in democratic accountability at all. I do think that the problem for people in the United States, and this was true 100 years ago or even 120 years ago, is that does democracy provide an effective mechanism to address these concerns that a growing number of people have? And if democracy can respond, then the system is healthy. But if democracy can't respond, then we're in some social trouble.
And now the laws have changed by way of Supreme Court decisions that make it increasingly easy for people of wealth to give as much money as they
want. That's correct. You and I now have exactly the same right to spend $10 million as the Koch brothers do on any candidate we like. It's, and again, this is not a new problem. Émile Zola, the French novelist in the 19th century, said that the rich and the poor have exactly the same right to sleep under a bridge. That's the situation that we're back to in a lot of ways. And again, whether or not, you know, you can really buy an election, political scientists debate this back and forth. But there is this growing perception that our democracy is for sale. And it doesn't take too much cynicism, too much corrosion of the faith in our system for it, for the wheels to come off. And this is something that people worried about in the 1930s. In the 1930s, what were the two economies in the world that looked like they were doing okay? Well, one was in Germany and the other was in the Soviet Union. And for a number of Americans in the 1930s, those became attractive alternatives to our mess. And that's, I think, why this inequality gap matters, because it really could well provide the kind of social unrest that I don't think we would want to see if the system doesn't respond to address these problems.
Well, Stephen Kahn, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
It's Stephen Kahn. He is a history professor at Ohio State University, where he is also in charge of the OSU Public History Program. Coming up, we're going to hear from the Heritage Foundation and some look at the problem and look at some possible solutions. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
You know, President Obama recently has been talking a great deal about income inequality, and I welcome that. I think it's great that the president's talking about income inequality. And in particular, I'd like him to address the undeniable reality that income inequality has gotten significantly worse under the Obama administration.
That's Republican Senator Ted Cruz challenging President Obama's economic policies, which, according to many Republicans, have perpetuated or made worse income inequality in the United States. But like Senator Cruz, several other conservative leaders have acknowledged now that there is an inequality, and that acknowledgement is something of a new phenomenon. So most sides agree that there's a gap. The depth and the breadth of that gap and the prescription to narrow that gap is what is up for debate. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and joining us now is Salim Firth. He's a senior policy analyst in macroeconomics at the Center for Data Analysis at the Heritage Foundation. It's a conservative think tank. Welcome to the show, Salim.
Thank you, Anne. It's great to be here this morning.
Some people think that the issue of income inequality is a liberal versus a conservative debate. What's your take on that? Do you think it is that simple, or has something changed?
Certainly, the liberals have decided to make this an important issue in their lexicon right now. I think conservatives, especially among economists, can sort of recognize what's in the data. Conservatives are more likely to look at some particular aspects of the problem. We're more concerned about mobility, the access that everyone has or doesn't have to the American dream, than we are about the outcome. And we're more concerned about unemployment and people being unable to work and provide for themselves than we are with, say, the wealth of the extremely wealthy, which doesn't affect, I think, most of us, even indirectly, on a day-to-day basis.
So when you talk about employment and being able to support a family, wages come into play there, right?
Absolutely.
Inequality has actually increased during the Obama administration. What's your explanation for the recent widening of the gap, and to what extent is this a function of, 6 years of policy or 60 years of policy?
That's a great question. So there's going to be some short-run things that are due to the recession, and that, the recession occurred before Obama became president. That's not his fault. But the tricky thing is, in recessions, usually inequality falls. In the 1930s, inequality fell rapidly because businesses became unprofitable. And the people who own businesses, their incomes rise and fall more in recessions and booms than the rest of ours. That evens out over the long run. But in, you know, 2009, 2010, inequality fell, at least at the top, because businesses were making losses. What's been strange is the recovery. Now, normally, everybody's going to sort of bounce back after a recession, and the rich who just took a lot of losses on their big businesses are going to get bigger gains than the rest of us. Again, this should even out over the cycle. What has been strange about this recovery is that we're not seeing new businesses form. So the people who own and are heavily invested in existing businesses are doing very well. Corporate profits are at record highs as a share of income. What we're not seeing is new businesses starting, and new businesses are those that tend to create jobs. In good times and bad, all net new jobs are created by new businesses. And new businesses tend to be particularly good matches for workers who are at the fringes of the economy. If you're a mid-career professional with a great resume, you can get a job at a large established business that pays well, expects 9 to 5 hours, and has a nice health plan for your family. If you're coming out of college, coming out of prison, 18 years old, and not sure what you want to do, often the best job for you, the job where you get paid the best and you have the best opportunity to prove yourself and advance, is with a new business. And new businesses tend to do things like expect their employees to work really long hours or not be certain if their job is going to exist in 3 months because, hey, we're starting out. We don't know if it's going to work. And so there's a natural match between workers at the margins and new businesses. And for reasons that I think are related to policy, we've seen no recovery at all in the creation of new businesses. It's still at a low, as if we were still in a recession as in 2009.
Now, Forbes magazine published a story about a year ago about a report that showed that the percentage of adults involved in startups, new businesses, in 2012 hit 13%, which was a record high since researchers had been checking those entrepreneurial rates since 1999.
I'm not familiar with that. I'd have to look that data up. I'm working off the Business Dynamics Statistics, which is published by, I believe, the BLS, but it could be a different agency. And then there was another recent report, a kind of a record low number on employment. So I'm not sure what Forbes source is.
That's
something I'll have to look at after the interview.
So new businesses, they create most of the new jobs. What are the policies that are in place that hurt startups or new businesses?
So I think the number one is the implementation of Dodd-Frank. After the housing crisis and then the financial crisis that spilled over into the real economy, there was a natural desire to do something to prevent this kind of crisis from occurring again. Unfortunately, what Dodd-Frank did was it put large existing banks at an advantage, that the super large banks are at an advantage, because basically they're labeled as too big to fail. They have that label applied, which is an implicit promise to investors that if there's another crisis, those huge banks will be bailed out and smaller ones won't be. New businesses tend to they're not getting their loans from Citibank or Chase Manhattan. They're getting loans from, you know, First National Bank of Springfield. And First National Bank of Springfield, I made that up, but they're small. They don't have a full-time compliance department. And even if we were to say, well, Dodd-Frank, there's nothing harmful in it, it's a lot of new rules. You need to understand those rules. They're changing the rules on what loans can be made, and there are potentially severe penalties if you make the wrong loan. There's no penalty for not making a loan. And that's the risk. Even if we like what's in Dodd-Frank, and there's a lot in there that I personally don't like, this has a great regulatory burden, compliance burden, on the banks that tend to make these startup loans. So I think that's the biggest policy. The healthcare reform is another one that raises the cost and some uncertainty issues about how in the future, how much will health insurance for my employees cost if I create a business, particularly if it's a fast-growing one that's going to pass that 50-employee threshold in a few years, what are my health insurance costs going to be? I think it's reasonable to say, again, I don't love the healthcare reform. Even if you like it, it's reasonable to say we don't really know how much insurance is going to cost in 3 years. And if you're starting up and you're writing a business plan, that's a big additional uncertainty. So those are my two candidates for why we haven't seen the usual rebound in business dynamic startups.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Salim Firth. He is with the Heritage Foundation, and we're talking about income inequality today and possibly some prescriptions for reviving or shrinking the gap between incomes in the United States. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Let's talk about healthcare reform briefly. Doesn't healthcare reform, however, also give startups the freedom to not have to offer health insurance because people can go out and get it on their own?
That's what it was supposed to do. I don't know that that has been accomplished.
Well,
that's certainly not the case for businesses that are over 50 employees. They're going to face a penalty if they don't offer health insurance.
Right. And then as far as new businesses creating jobs, it seems like a lot of the tax breaks out there are geared toward existing businesses and big businesses that don't necessarily create jobs.
Absolutely. And one excellent reform that we should pursue is changing our corporate income tax structure. Right now, the marginal rate is, I believe, 35%, and the average rate is less than half of that, last I checked. That changes year to year. But basically what that means is if you don't have any breaks or you're not kind of structured to avoid taxes, you're paying a very, very high tax rate. But then some other people who do have that structure and do have those lawyers are paying a much, much lower rate.
Mm-hmm.
And a reform, I think everybody on all sides agrees this in principle should be done. It's hard to do. It's hard to get this through Congress. But lower the rate, take in the same amount of revenue, get rid of a lot of the exceptions and lawyering that are part of that code right now. And the lower the rate is, the less incentive there is to go and find an exception to change your business model around to try to find a lower tax rate. So if the rate is 20% instead of 35%, it's that much less worthwhile to find an exception in the law that works for you, even if that exception is still there.
When it comes to income, well, we can't be absolutely shooting for equality. That, I think everyone agrees, isn't what the ultimate goal is. And you made the salient point that we're not really worried about the 1% per se. We're worried about boosting the opportunity for the rest of us. So what are we shooting for? What should our goal be? How do you define that?
That's a great question. I actually spoke to some Danish economists who visited D.C. recently, and they said income inequality is a really big deal in Denmark, and there's strong pressure from the parties on the left there to lower income inequality. Now, Denmark has the lowest measured income inequality in the developed world. So I think for some people, and this is appropriate in a democracy, for some people, any level or any observed level of income inequality is aesthetically unpleasing, that it makes them feel like life is unfair, parents probably told you this, life is unfair. And that there's always going to be some democratic pressure to say, well, this just needs to be lower. That's distinct from maybe thinking about each person on their own. How well are they going to do in life? Are they going to have opportunities? And Denmark, despite that very, very low inequality, has some pretty big problems. It's got a persistent unemployment problem. Growth has really slowed down there. They're not sort of sharing in the Swedish growth experience right now. So it's not like lowering inequality is a panacea to other problems. I know some researchers have tried to tie inequality to everything from economic growth to health outcomes, and I'm pretty skeptical. I think inequality is usually, and in an academic economic models, it's almost always an outcome of the way the economy is structured and the way that markets work. It's very rarely considered an input into these things. I think the biggest policies that we have to think about, the three biggest ones, are education, education, and education.
Hmm. Bill in Troy, you're on the air with Salim Firth of the Heritage Foundation. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Good morning, Bill.
I have a question for your guest. We're all sort of ignoring the 6,000-pound elephant that's in the room with us here. The shipment of jobs overseas, I know we've heard that over and over and over again. Do you see anything in the future that will help or induce employers to make jobs here in the United States rather than shipping over? Thank you for taking my call. I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Salim?
That's a great question. That actually is tied into income inequality in some very interesting ways. He's certainly right. We live in a more globalized world. I don't particularly like the phrase shipping jobs overseas. There's always jobs are coming and going everywhere, and I don't resent workers in other countries who are willing to do the same work that we're doing and can produce the same product more cheaply. One of the biggest reasons, and I just said that inequality is an outcome. One of the biggest reasons for rising inequality in America is that there's a globalized economy. Now, what's strange about this is that the same force that is increasing inequality in the U.S. is decreasing it globally. So if we were to, say, dial back policies to like a 1960s level of trade openness, that would probably, it would lower incomes across the board. It would lower inequality and in the U.S., but it would raise inequality globally. So if you care as much about inequality between people of different nations as you do about inequality within the country, then this is actually a golden age. If you look at research by Professor Branko Milanovic, he's shown that there's a huge increase in the incomes of the people who are at the middle of the global income distribution, the global middle class. They're much poorer than the American middle class, who are right up at the top. And so this very strange thing, inequality is rising in a lot of countries, but falling globally. And it's because of a leading cause of this is globalization. I don't think we want to reverse that. I don't think we want to say, well, let's kick the Indian and Chinese workers to the curb. The only people we care about are Americans, and we're going to do things that hurt the world economy just so we can get a little bit of a benefit for American manufacturing workers. The bad news, to answer Bill's question, is that the way to compete in a globalized world is to accept lower wages. And if we persist in trying to force employers to raise wage rates through minimum wages or required healthcare insurance, that's going to raise the cost of American labor and make it more likely that employers will set up shops somewhere else.
But how do you wash that with the cost of living in the United States being such that a person can work at least one full-time job, if not more, and still not be able to afford a decent place to live, be able to clothe their children properly, be able to send their kids to college?
I mean, things aren't free. People in the developing world have much, much greater difficulties affording the same things. When we mm-hmm. do international comparisons of income, we're looking at purchasing power. We're not just looking at the dollar value. Mm-hmm. So we're taking into account that say housing in India is much cheaper than here.
Right.
We're taking that into account. People have struggles. This is the history of humanity. Material goods are not just free for the taking.
And
we've always had to struggle for those, and Americans have to struggle for those, and workers around the world do as well.
And you said that you can't quarrel with the fact that people in other countries can put out the same. Can have the same level of productivity for a business, but do it more cheaply. But often in those countries, they're doing it more cheaply, not just in terms of wages, but in terms of worker safety, worker benefits, that sort of thing. And some people might say that they're being exploited.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly cases. And if we look, the world's a big place. If we look around, we're going to find some cases of just straight exploitation, mm-hmm. and those should be dealt with. On an individual basis and mm-hmm. with a sense of justice. And, in a place like China where they're far, far from a free market, it's sort of a corporatist, government-led industrialization, there's going to be some serious problems where you have the government on the side of very big industrial concerns coming in and taking family farms, that sort of thing. That's absolutely a problem. There, I don't have any sense that if we somehow got rid of bad worker conditions or government tipping the scales in the favor of some of these industrialists in some places, that would raise, you know, Chinese or Thai or Indonesian wages to American levels.
Okay.
Even
with that,
poorer countries that are treating their workers well, they're still going to be able to produce certain things more cheaply than the U.S. I'm reminded, you know, when Jackie Robinson broke into the big leagues, the Dodgers shortstop, I believe it was Pee Wee Reese, mm-hmm. who's a young Southern, obviously white guy, and he said, you know, hey, if somebody can play baseball better than me, if he can take my job, then he's entitled to it. And we're not going to sort of create reservations for people like us or, you know, say that, well, you know, we had it first, so we should be able to keep it. Mm-hmm. If someone can play baseball better, they should be able to get that position.
Salim Firth, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Salim Firth. He's a senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. Coming up, we'll hear from the research director for Policy Matters Ohio. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. According to a recent study published this year by the Economic Analysis and Research Network, inequality exists in all 50 states. Historically, the income gap in Ohio has been less extreme than in other states, but the Buckeye State is not immune. In 2011, the Economic Analysis and Research Network issued a report that said the average income for the top 1% in Ohio is almost $700,000. That's the average income for the top 1% in Ohio. That was compared with nearly an average of nearly $39,000 for the other 99%. That's an 18-to-1 ratio that ranked Ohio 29th in the nation. Connecticut and New York, in contrast, have ratios above 40-to-1. So joining us now is the research director at the liberal-leaning think tank Policy Matters Ohio, Zach Schiller, to talk about that. Welcome back to the show, Zach.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm okay. Conservatives are taking up this mantle, the issue of inequality. Liberal and conservative policies may not always agree, but is there hope if both sides acknowledge that there is a problem?
Yeah, I think it's a good thing that we're seeing a robust debate about inequality. It's about time. We've seen about a 35-year trend in this direction nationally, and so I certainly can't quarrel with us talking about it a lot more. That's the first step toward doing something. Whether we can reach any kind of agreement is another matter. Your last guest enlisted Jackie Robinson on the side of free trade. I can't say I'd ever heard that before, but this is just one element in what we've seen, which is really, this is a generational trend. So looking at what's happened in the past 2 or 3 years, while it's not irrelevant, really doesn't get at the key issues. And one of them, just to cite something that your last guest talked about, is our trade policy. You know, our trade policy as a country has been to basically favor free trade, regardless of the conditions under which companies operate. And this has helped lead to, I looked up some statistics before our talk this morning. 30 years ago, 41% of the manufacturing employees in Ohio, or 462,000 Ohioans, had union manufacturing jobs. That number last year was 118,000. We've lost almost 350,000 unionized manufacturing jobs in this state over the past 30 years. And while I don't know exactly how many of them are unionized, I'd say at least 50,000 and probably more were jobs that were certified by the U.S. government to have been lost to trade. And, you know, we have basically endorsed a policy in which we will ship jobs overseas, which I think is a very reasonable way to talk about it, under conditions that too often are not something that we would allow in this country and that basically shouldn't be allowed anywhere, whether it's the environmental conditions or the working conditions or you name it. So, you know, this has led to, it's one of the factors among a number that have led to a weakening of unions it's very clear that unions play a very important role in decreasing inequality and allowing workers to bargain collectively in a way that allows them to have a bigger share of the pie. And it's one factor in our inequality that's grown in Ohio and across the country has been the weakening of unions, so they no longer have that ability in many instances. And that's one factor that's a long-term factor in creating that. And so conversely, we should be doing something to support them, to promote them, not to attack them. And I think that that's one element, if you're looking at what we should do, that we should be considering if we're trying to talk about cutting inequality.
Can we bring, if unions, you said it's one factor, but let's talk about that factor for just a second. You've already told us the numbers and the shrinkage of unions in the United States. Do you think that that can turn around?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, I think it's one thing that we would like to see. It's only one factor among many that's led to this rise in inequality. We've seen also, for example, the rise of the financial industry. You know, we saw basically a gigantic growth in the financial industry in this country under whoever president it was. It was not a partisan issue. We deregulated it. We saw, you know, financial calamity as a result, but we still didn't really do the job. And so, you know, we did some modest changes with Dodd-Frank to suggest that that's behind inequality. To me, is ludicrous. You're taking a 30-year trend and blaming, you know, inequality on a law that's only barely gotten started. In fact, one of the reasons why Ohio has less inequality than a state like New York is because we don't have as many billionaires who've made money off hedge funds.
Mm-hmm.
And so we haven't profited as much. We don't have our top 1%, that 700,000 average that you referred to earlier.
It's peanuts.
It's not as high as it is in a state like New York because we don't have as many of those folks. And I would argue that that is not what we should be striving for. In other words, you know, allowing more people to be billionaires to me is not the way to either generate economic growth or cut inequality. And, you know, I think that a key point from a state level is, what are we doing about it? There are a limited number of things that a state can do about this kind of thing, because most of these issues are national or even global trends that trying to cope with them at the state level can be difficult. But the couple of things that we could certainly think about is are these. One, we could do more investing over the long term in education. Your last guest and I can certainly agree on the need for public education. I think that it's been, you know, widely agreed among virtually everyone who's studied it that having robust preschool education for everybody is something that will have a long-term economic benefit for everyone, will help level the playing field so everyone will have equal opportunity. Similarly, at the state level, we should increase our aid to low-income college students who need support. Right now, if you're a community college student, you can't get the main need-based aid that Ohio offers. That's ludicrous. We should be allowing community college students to get that, and we should be going back to where we were a few years back in the levels of aid that we provided. So in other words, we can invest more in education throughout the whole, you know, from preschool through college. And in order to do that, we need the resources to do so. How do we do that? Well, we can generate revenue by taxing the people who can afford it. And we've been going in the exact opposite direction. One thing that we've done as a state is we're actually increasing inequality because we continue to pass income tax cuts. The income tax, the state income tax, is the only major tax that taxes people in relation to how much they make. And so when we cut the income tax, as our General Assembly is doing even this week again, we are basically reinforcing the inequality that we've seen occurring in Ohio. And so why is it that that would be good policy? You know, if we're talking about what we should do about inequality, at the very least, the state should not be increasing it through the tax system by increasing the extent to which low-income people pay more and rich people pay less.
Lawmakers would say when we take the tax burden off of the people with the capital, they'll spend more money making more jobs.
Well, I don't think you can look around you and see that that hasn't worked.
Well, Governor Kasich takes credit for reducing the unemployment rate, and aren't jobs what it's all about?
Well, the last time that we had an unemployment rate that we do now, Ohio had 200,000 more people in the labor force and 180,000 more workers.
So the raw numbers have changed.
I'm glad to see that the unemployment rate is down. That's obviously a good thing, but I think that a good chunk of this is because many people have given up and they're not in the labor force, so they're not even counted. So I'm certainly happy to see that we've seen some improvement, but let's face it, you know, the economy as a whole nationally has not recovered anywhere near as much as we'd like, and Ohio has not really gained ground on the country despite all these tax cuts. And they go back 9 years now. You know, when these were passed 9 years ago, a 21% cut in the state income tax, we were told that this was going to do what you just described. Well, it hasn't. We haven't made up the ground that we lost in the recession. We're still well behind the country as a whole, and the country as a whole, we know, is not doing as well as we'd like.
Donnie in Dayton, you're on the air with Zach Schiller from Policy Matters Ohio. Hi, Donnie.
Hello. You know, I don't feel middle class anymore. I'm 52. And I've was in manufacturing, like you were speaking of, a machinist. And, you know, I've gone down through the years from $18 to $19 an hour jobs to a $12 an hour job. So I have to wonder about the future of the middle class. I've never been a unionized labor person. I've never worked for a union. And I've slowly seen the union companies here in Dayton, the Delphi's and the Delcos, you know, they've all packed up and left town and taken their businesses to Mexico and to cheaper labor forces. But yet the cost of living keeps going up. I am a two-job household. My wife does work. But even with the economy as it is, you know, we're still struggling. So I have to wonder, you know, what would possibly be the future of the middle class?
Zach, what is a middle class anymore? What does it mean? Thanks, Donnie.
Well, that's a kind of a broad question. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I can answer it easily, but I think that obviously you'd like to have a somewhat comfortable existence so you're not living paycheck to paycheck and you don't have to worry about financial calamity if you should get sick or if you should have an accident or, you know, anything else should befall you. I think that that's one thing. Another is, of course, that you would have some opportunity to improve your life and that of your children and people in your family. So I think that this is increasingly jeopardized for far too many people. I think that the answer of some seems to be let's knock out the props that do exist to help people, you know, whether it's basic benefits, food stamps, unemployment insurance, things that you know, or allow people to maintain themselves and perhaps if they're fallen on hard times, find a way to get up from it. But also, I think, you know, one other element in all of this is we have reduced our support for public services. We don't think that, you know, we've cut 40,000 local government jobs in this state over the past 5 years. And besides the services that they provide, which are important, whether it's police or fire or, you know, good roads, whatever it might be, those are positions that have everybody as much importance in the economy as does somebody working at J.P. Morgan Chase or at Ford Motor Company or a private sector job. And we have devalued our public sector. We've said, oh, these people, these aren't really jobs. The Kasich administration doesn't even include public sector jobs when he gives his numbers on how many jobs have been created, probably because we've lost jobs in that sector, maybe one reason. But
they tend to spend a larger percentage of their income, too.
But it displays a real, I think, lack of regard for how many communities in Ohio are these crucial supports where they may even be the best jobs available. Mm-hmm. And but it's not just that we're doing it because they're good jobs, but because they are creating some of the infrastructure, some of the fabric that is what allows our economy to function, that makes us attractive to businesses. You know, you want a functioning public safety system, mm-hmm. you know, to have a business. So I think that there's a whole ideology abroad that suggests that, you know, everyone for themselves, the government has no role in anything. And I think that this is a key element in making inequality more likely and in making it more difficult for us to allow people to remain and increase the middle class.
Zach Schiller, the conversation will continue. I hope you'll join us again for it.
Great. Thanks very much.
Zach Schiller, Research Director for Policy Matters Ohio. Like I said, the conversation continues on inequality, income inequality in Ohio and across the country and around the world. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.